Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us. This is the ABA Art and Cultural Heritage Law Committee's second telecoffee discussion. We are recording this call, and we'll post the audio file to the committee's webpage to be accessed later by anyone who wasn't able to join. So we would like to ask that all listeners please mute your lines during the call. If you have any questions, you may email them to me at JacquelineFarinella@gmail.com. And the spelling, my email address is actually in the invitation to this call that was sent out on Friday. And we'll address any questions at the conclusion of the discussion as time permits. So let's get started. On today's telecoffee discussion, we'll be talking with Patty Gerstenbliss about the recent discovery of artwork in Germany. Patty is Distinguished Research Professor of Law at DePaul University and director of its Center for Art, Museum, and Cultural Heritage Law, as well as the immediate past chair of this committee. In 2011, President Obama appointed Patty to chair the Cultural Property Advisory Committee in the U.S. Department of State, to which she had been previously appointed by President Clinton. Patty has an AB from Bryn Mawr, a PhD in art history and anthropology from Harvard, and a JD from Northwestern. She's the author of numerous books and articles addressing cultural heritage preservation, and she speaks frequently on the topic. Patty, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure, Jacqueline.
So in November, German authorities announced the discovery of over 1,400 paintings in the home of Cornelius Gurlitt, whose father was an art dealer in the 1940s and was allegedly involved in the removal of artwork from galleries and museums that was deemed degenerate under Nazi law. You could tell us a little more about this discovery and the possible history of these artworks.
Sure. As you said, about 1,400 paintings and other kinds of drawings were discovered in the apartment of Cornelius Gurlitt in Munich. It actually had been discovered about 2 years ago at this point, but was only announced in November. It's unclear exactly what the background of all these artworks is, but obviously that created a very large outcry amongst people in the art market, but most particularly, of course, the families of Holocaust victims. So the discovery and the announcement of the discovery certainly has created a lot of legal issues and other types of issues between countries that are still being sorted out at this point. So we might want to think of the objects as falling into four categories. And in fact, the noted art historian and history of the artworks during the Holocaust, Lynn Nicholas, pointed this out several months ago, that we could think of the objects as falling into four categories. One would be works that were, in fact, legitimately owned by the Gurlitt family. As you mentioned, Cornelius's father, Hildebrand, was himself an art dealer, and much of the family, if you go back over several generations, was involved in the arts in various ways, including members of the family who were themselves artists, painters, etc. So some of these works might, in fact, be legitimately owned by the Gurlitt family. The second group would be works that were removed from German museums under German law in the mid-1930s after the Nazis came to power. They decided to remove what they considered to be degenerate art from German museum collections. And some of these were sold abroad in order to raise foreign currency for the Nazi government. But it seems likely that some of these works did end up in the Gurlitt collection. The collection that was recently discovered. The third group would be works that were removed from collections, primarily in Paris, such as the Rosenberg collection, that were liquidated when the Nazis took over France. And it seems that Hildebrand Gurlitt was one of the dealers who was assigned the task of liquidating and then selling these works into, again, foreign collections, or may have been held by him as well. The fourth category might be works that were bought by Hildebrand from those victims of the Holocaust, victims of the Nazis, who were trying to escape or for some other reason needed to sell off their collection. And those we can think of as works that were sold under duress. So each of those four categories would raise different both legal and what we consider to be moral or ethical issues as well.
Great. Well, maybe we could discuss the legal ramifications then of the discovery and the process a family would need to follow if they believe they are descendants of prior owners of the artwork.
Right. Well, the biggest problem, first of all, is finding out what's in the collection. It's taken the German authorities a long time. As I said, they didn't announce the discovery for close to 2 years. And they are only now under considerable pressure from foreign governments, including the United States, as well as some of the prominent families, such as the Rosenberg family. They're only now gradually putting these works on the internet so that people can search those works and try to identify things that they think belonged to their families. Again, thinking of those four categories, the first might, in fact, those objects might, in fact, be legally owned by Gurlitt. The second, the works that were removed from German museums raised some of very interesting issues, which are that when a government expropriates or takes property from its own citizens within its own territory, this may in fact be an act that is not to be questioned by U.S. courts under what's called the Act of State Doctrine. The history of the Act of State Doctrine applied to property expropriated during World War II by the Nazi governments or by those governments that were sympathetic to the Nazis is a very complicated one, but because the U.S. government has indicated, the State Department has indicated to the courts that they that the State Department does not view it important to our foreign relations to defer to the acts of the Nazi regime. And so many of those acts have not fallen under the Act of State Doctrine, which means we would view such actions as theft. But it's not clear that that policy, because the Act of State Doctrine is a function of policy, it's not a function of affirmative positive law. It's a little bit unclear how the Act of State Doctrine would apply to an action by German authorities removing artworks from their own collections, from their own museums' collections. And it does seem possible, at least, that some of those works have been sold in the last few years by Cornelius Gurlitt onto the market. He seems to have been slowly selling a few of these works off, presumably in order to raise funds for him to live off of and his sister as well. So it would present a very, almost a novel, I think, legal question if such a work had been sold into, let's say, the United States, and a German museum attempted to recover such a work. So it's very unclear how the Act of State Doctrine would apply in U.S. courts. There is some discussion in Germany of trying to change the law under which degenerate art was removed, but it's not clear whether it's going to happen yet. That would enable German museums to try to collect directly from Gurlitt himself. The third and the fourth categories, if we assume for the moment, and again, it's not an entirely settled issue, but if we assume that a sale under duress should be equated to a theft, for which there is some good law both in the United States and certainly under German law, the question for a family trying to recover a work would be the statute of limitations. In Germany, there's a 30-year statute of limitations, regardless of whether the location of the work was known by the claimant. And regardless of whether the current possessor was acting in good faith or in bad faith. This law would present a fairly serious impediment to recovery by a family whose work had been stolen. But it's not clear if such a work had been sold to, let's say, the United States, the statute of limitations in most states in the United States is much more forgiving to the claimant who doesn't know where the artworks were located. It does seem that these 1,400 or so works were kept secret and hidden. So even a diligent potential claimant would not have known how to locate or where to locate the stolen property. So in the United States, generally speaking, the U.S. courts would be much more, as I said, forgiving or flexible towards a claimant. But in Germany, this is a much stricter rule. There's been some discussion, in fact, of Germany changing or the local regional authorities changing the way the statute of limitations work. And I think the most interesting thing is just a few days ago, Gurlitt's lawyer said that he would not stand behind the statute of limitations. He would consider negotiations, discussions with claimant families, and that he was willing to abide by what's called the Washington Conference Principles, which were principles adopted at a conference in Washington, D.C. in 1998 that set out principles for the restitution of artworks and other types of cultural objects to descendants, to claimants. So this is a very important and brand new development if this carries out, because that would mean in all likelihood that the German statute of limitations would not serve as an impediment, and at least in the cases where the descendants could establish with clarity that these were their works that had been taken one way or the other and ended up in this Gurlitt collection, those descendants would in fact seem to have a very good claim and good possibility of recovering their works. So I think one of the biggest obstacles right now is simply getting the information out as to what these works are and enable descendants, families to research their possible claims and then to negotiate with the Gurlitt, with Cornelius Gurlitt and his attorney to in fact recover their works.
So maybe we can talk more generally about the current situation for families who are looking to recover artwork, and that kind of comes off of what you just said, both in Europe and then maybe how the situation could differ for families looking to recover artwork that's located in the U.S. using those same principles.
Yes, the situation in the United States and in Europe is quite different depending on a number of variables. As I mentioned, in the United States, a lot of these cases have turned on the statute of limitations or in New York State on the equitable defense of latches. In the United States, following the common law and in the law of individual states, a thief can never transfer good title. So as long as there was a theft in the chain of title of a work of art, the current possessor, even if the current possessor has acted in good faith, does not have title to the work. And the original owner or the claimant through the original owner should be able to recover his or her work. The problem becomes the statute of limitations, which in most states is a relatively short period of time, just a few years. And obviously anything from looted, stolen during the Holocaust would theoretically be barred by the statute of limitations. However, the statutes of limitations generally give this time period from the time when the cause of action accrues without defining the accrual of the cause of action. So in most states in the United States, and California and New York are exceptions to this, but in all the other states that have addressed this issue, the states have adopted what's called the discovery or due diligence rule, which is that as long as the claimant or the potential claimant is searching diligently for his or her stolen property and acts with that diligence, from the time that he or she does discover or should have discovered the location of the painting, then the statute of limitations will not bar the claim. So those cases can go forward. This is, of course, assuming you can prove that it is the same painting that was owned by my grandmother Sadie, or that I am, in fact, Grandma Sadie was, in fact, the owner, and I am the proper claimant as her descendant. So in most states, the accrual of the cause of action is delayed until the claimant would know or with reasonable diligence should have known the location and the current possessor to sue to recover the artwork. New York and California are a little different. New York uses what's called the demand and refusal rule, which is the cause of action does not accrue until the claimant brings a demand for the return of the property and the current possessor refuses, which is obviously very favorable towards the claimant. However, the courts have also used what's called the equitable defense of latches, which in some senses incorporates some of the principles of the discovery or due diligence rule. So in the equitable defense of latches, there's two prongs. The first is that the claim will be barred if, first, the claimant has delayed unreasonably in bringing the suit. And secondly, and this is important, that delay, that unreasonable delay, has caused legal prejudice to the current possessor. And that legal prejudice is usually an evidentiary one, that is, that evidence important to the claim, or the defense, I should say. So evidence that is important to the defense of the current possessor has been lost, and that the defendant has to be fairly particular about what kind of evidence has been lost and how that would change his or her case. And secondly, the other kind of prejudice would be essentially a reliance, a change of position based on the claimant's delay, and therefore the defendant's not knowing that the property is stolen property. And this was just recently affirmed by the New York Court of Appeals in a very interesting case called the Flammenbaum decision, which if you're interested, we can talk about a little bit more depending on the time. California has also had an interesting series of cases and attempts by the legislature to change the statute of limitations. Initially, the statute of limitations was changed specifically for the recovery of artworks looted during the Holocaust to extend the time period. That was struck down by the Ninth Circuit as unconstitutional under the Foreign Affairs Preemption Doctrine. However, the California legislature revised the statute not to refer specifically to Holocaust works, but any artwork stolen during the last 100 years. And that statute was just recently upheld by the Ninth Circuit in the Casera case. So at this point, California has an extended period of time under its statute of limitations, and that legislation also adopted the equitable defense of latches in recovery cases, but there has not yet been any significant litigation that would explain how the California courts will apply the equitable defense of latches, but one can assume they would probably follow the similar approach to what the New York courts have done so far. So in the United States, much of this will turn on this issue of time period. Of course, the Washington Conference principles and principles adopted by the AAM, the American Alliance of Museums, suggest to museums that they should not rely on what are called technical defenses, which is basically the statute of limitations and latches, but rather try to resolve these claims based specifically on factual questions of who is the proper owner and that type of thing. In Europe, I'll just say very briefly, there is what's called the good faith purchaser doctrine. If somebody acquires property that may have been stolen in good faith, there's a relatively short period of time after which the current possessor does get good title, which makes it much more difficult to recover works in Europe that are held by a private owner. The only advantage in Europe is that the museums are mostly state-owned museums, and so if the government decides to return something, and several European countries have set up some kind of commission to adjudicate these disputes without litigation, and quite a few pieces have been returned from different museums, it's a few in the UK, more in the Netherlands, and Germany, and some of the other countries. Those can be returned because they are subject to whatever the national government decides that they should do, or whatever regional authority may own the museum. In contrast to the United States, where, of course, most of the museums are not government museums and cannot be told to give up their property by the national government. So the situation in the United States and in Europe is actually quite different, and the process is quite different between litigation versus some form of arbitration or adjudication through a panel or a commission.
Great. Thank you very much. We did get a question over email. Are you willing to take a few minutes to address
sure.
it? Okay. So this question is from Peter Tampa. Peter says, there seems to be an international consensus that Holocaust art should be returned to its true owners or heirs, even if it's been transferred to a bona fide purchaser or state museum. And he's asking your views on why this principle isn't applied to the Iraqi Jewish archive. He goes on to say, while some of the documents in the archive are about Iraqi Jews, others were obviously either directly taken from Iraqi Jews or they were forced to abandon them under Iraqi law to gain exit from the country. Do you have any views on that?
First of all, this has not been litigated in courts. And so it's to say there's no consensus out there that these things don't belong to the descendants I think is an incorrect statement. And I don't think there is a consensus out there at the moment. I certainly think that items that are specifically identifiable as having a descendant, and my understanding is that these would be things like school report cards and the like, I personally think those do belong to the descendants and could perhaps find some way of returning those to the correct descendants. So my answer would be I don't think there's a consensus. There's been no litigation. There's been no general statement from, equivalent to the Washington Conference Principles, which set out sets out what we would regard as the consensus agreement. You also have, in the case of World War II, contemporary statements such as the London Declaration of 1943, which specifically says that transactions entered into by victims of the Holocaust will not be regarded as legitimate, even if they seem to have some veneer of legitimacy attached to them, such as a so-called sale. So in that sense, there are differences, but I disagree that there is a consensus which is being ignored on the Iraqi materials.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Patty, this is Peter Topp. I think you didn't hear it correctly. I was saying there's a consensus on Holocaust materials, not the Iraqi materials.
Well, I guess I can't answer why if you're saying there's no consensus on the Iraqi materials, I'm not sure I can answer why there isn't. It's a relatively, as you know, something that's only gotten attention relatively recently in the last few months, and perhaps there just hasn't been a chance for such a consensus to coalesce.
My point on the consensus was like the Holocaust materials, though, not the Iraqi materials. I just want that to be clear.
I mean, there is a consensus on the Holocaust materials, but there have certainly been cases where things have not been returned. And that's all been sort of fought out through litigation, primarily, both in Europe and in the United States. It's not like everything just automatically goes back. As I'm sure you know, many museums have, in fact, resisted claims and have contested those in court. So we tend to think there's a consensus outside of the legal framework, as it were, but when you look into the actual litigated cases, not everything goes back to the claimants. And there are a lot of individual factual circumstances that are brought to bear on those cases, including things like, oh, you didn't bother to register your stolen artworks back in the late 1940s, or your grandfather had an opportunity to recover it and didn't bother. So I certainly agree there's a general consensus, but it doesn't always result in restitution.
Okay. I mean, I guess the interesting point here is the federal government is the one that's holding it, and the government in other cases has certainly taken the position that Holocaust art should be repatriated. So I guess from their perspective, there is kind of a disconnect in my mind, at least.
Well, it won't be the first. I mean, there are other cases where, for example, the United States government was litigating the Portrait of Wally case, saying that painting should go back to the family, not returned to Austria. They brought a civil forfeiture claim for the Portrait of Wally. At the same time that the federal government was submitting a statement of interest in the Altman litigation, saying that they did not think that there was a basis for Altman to sue Austria, same country, in California. Now, is that inconsistent? Certainly some people would say that was inconsistent.
Right.
But, I'm not sure I can explain that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's fine. Thank you, then.
Sure.
Thanks very much. I haven't seen any other questions come through, so why don't we conclude the call? We're just about out of time anyway, but thank you very much for your time, and thanks for joining us for this discussion, everyone. Really appreciate it. Thanks, Patty.
Okay, thank you, too.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Bye-bye.
Bye.
leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.